We're good to go. All right. Well, let's go ahead and call this meeting to order at 8:47. And Nicole, if you can take roll.
Fred Crick.
Present.
Ashley Monroe.
Present.
Joella Sparks. Adam Kane.
Present.
Kirsten Bay.
Present.
Evelyn Pinsgord. Selena Brown. Sarah Batiste. Deb Jepson. Mary Alice Short. Debbie Gonzalez. Leslie Walls.
Present.
Debbie Coxon.
Here.
Jesse Atencio. Aaron Albertson. Greg Simpson.
Present.
Kim Eames. Debbie Blevins. Juan Gula.
Here.
Robin Weiland.
Here.
Trish Winters.
Here.
Jennifer Youngberg. Jeanette Altman.
Present.
Travis Brenzo. Richard Machida.
Here.
Jarkko Toivonen. Chris Bex. Tom Langdon. Cindy Collins. Tony Abbey.
Okay, we have quorum, so let's go ahead and get the meeting started. Item 1C, approval of the agenda for today's meeting. I have one immediate change, and that is the minutes for 241 will be postponed to October. Are there any other changes to the agenda? I will accept a motion to approve the agenda as amended.
So moved.
Second.
Is there anyone opposed to accepting the agenda as amended? Okay, hearing none, we have an agenda. So item two, we have no pending actions. Oh, and I should add that we may have to move some things around in the agenda as time's needed to talk about other things or to allow our guests time to talk. So on that note, item three, public comment, we'll come back to that in 10 minutes. So let's go ahead and start 15 minutes early with officer reports. And I'm going to start with a few things and then pass the mic to Ashley and then finish up with one last item. So the first item, and with apologies to everyone on the phone, because everyone who's called in today, you're allowing us to have quorum. I think we're almost split half and half right now, maybe a little heavier in the room, but not by much. But I learned recently, I did not know this, that we pay per caller per minute for the audio conference software, or not software, but capability. So if you can come to a meeting in person, that would be helpful. I understand that sometimes you just can't come to a meeting. That happens. But if you can make it, that is good for the governance budget. Every little bit helps. This Thursday at 1 p.m. in the Davis Concert Hall is convocation. I invite everyone to come and attend and encourage you to talk to your coworkers and your constituents and let them know that convocation is happening, and if they have time, they should come. We also, or sorry, 3 weeks ago, roughly, I met with Brad Lobland, and we had a good discussion on some of the HR-related items that have come up, some of the things we talked about last week, like the possibility of a smoke-free campus, employee compensation, you know, encouraging employees to stay, or you know, finding ways to help employees. One of the things that he said was that he'd like HR to be more accessible to staff. And I invited him to attend our meetings, or his staff to attend our meetings. And he's been invited as a guest speaker in October to come introduce himself, talk about HR, and take questions from staff counsel. So with that, I'll turn the mic over to Ashley, unless there are any questions for me about those items.
All right. So an update from our last meeting, we had talked about the CDAC committee, the Chancellor's Diversity Action Committee. That is still on the books. However, it is on hiatus. They have not met. The Chancellor is working to make some changes to that committee so that actions can happen out of that committee. So he is revitalizing, revamping, and should start up soon. There's going to be with changes to the layout. As for the smoke-free campus issue, we did talk with Chancellor Rogers again regarding the smoke-free campus issue. He does feel like it is going to be something that is going to become more and more popular as we hear about it because of some movement in Anchorage at the UAA campus, and so it is something that we want to tackle. We had talked at our last meeting regarding a statewide survey. However, that is not rolling out, and so we're hoping that perhaps Staff Affairs could create a survey for UAF that we could get out and make sure that Chancellor Rogers can see the responses, whether it's for or against a smoke-free campus. Yeah, of course. Yes. Yep. And we can share with you the one that statewide has so that you can see the similar questions. They did send it out, had some different responses, and had to actually revamp it and send it out again because people are confused on what smoke-free means. That actually means smoke-free, not just smoking in designated areas. So, let's see. Update on the wellness program. Wynn has gone to court over the selection of the wellness program, so everything is kind of on pause until the judge makes a decision. So that is still ongoing. Protection of minors, we did adopt a policy in May, and Chancellor Rogers did mention that they're going to be rolling out a training that would be mandatory for anyone who works with minors on campus or has potential to work with minors on campus, and that training should roll out in October or November of this year. In addition to that, there is also a bullying training, lots of new trainings this year. Bullying training started as President Gamble's thing after a staff survey, and staff indicated that there is bullying happening within UA campuses. And so he tasked General Counsel and HR with creating a training regarding bullying. That has started for statewide employees and I believe is mandatory for all statewide employees to participate in. Staff Alliance is working currently on a resolution to in support of the bullying training and in support of each chancellor to make bullying training mandatory on their campuses. So that's something to keep in mind for the future, that could be potentially affecting you and UAF with that bullying training coming home.
Can I make a comment on
yes.
that? This is Chris. For those of you on the phone, Chris Bex with Unit 15. I think it's a good idea on the training for the bullying, the anti-bullying training. With 10 days notice in the first week of classes, poor planning. Okay, I think many staff are involved in the startup of the semester, even though we don't have to teach classes. And that doesn't work for a number of the employees in my unit. And if that's a required training, that's going to look bad on us, and there really isn't anything we can do about that. So I'd like to give some feedback to that, and that's just poor planning. It's not like the training's bad or unnecessary. I actually think it's very necessary and excellent. But with very little notice during the busiest time of the year.
So at statewide, there was just one training offered, and it wasn't, there's not multiple times or anything like that. Is that,
yeah.
that I understand
yep.
what you're saying?
Okay. No, there were multiple times, but they're all within the same 2 or 3 day period.
Okay.
Interesting. That's good feedback because I found out the day that the training was happening that it was happening with no advance notice. Of course, I don't work at statewide, so I wasn't required to attend, but that was interesting because we just talked about this at our Staff Alliance retreat in early August, and it was something that they were saying wouldn't be ready for a while.
Mm-hmm.
And then to find out that it happened was interesting.
Well, just to give you an example, the support center where I work, I mean, we have a no annual leave for the first 3 weeks, or the 3 weeks before and the 3 weeks after the start of the semester, so that Thursday. Because we are, I mean, it's go time. Everybody be 110%. And there is no time for really anything else that could wait till later. Because all the critical stuff, everything gets prioritized. It's students, faculty, all hands on deck. And anyway, I think it's poor planning to do this the first week of classes. And with me, not necessarily me, but I've heard a lot of feedback from the people in at least my department and in my unit.
So you're being bullied. Right?
There you go. I'm being bullied.
Well, we will share that with our counterparts, I think, at Statewide Assembly so that they have that information.
So, and if nothing else, I would like to suggest to offer that training again maybe in November or so. Right? That those of us who couldn't attend this time can do that.
Yeah. So, 9, and I believe we have someone here for a public comment. So, would you like to come up to a microphone? Welcome.
Hi. So, I'm Amanda Wall. I'm from the Bursar's office, and Ashley had mentioned that not everybody on the executive board was aware that parking had moved under the Bursar's office. This was a result of about 2 years' worth of deliberation with a committee focusing on student services. And the goal was to combine services that students needed so that they had more of a one-stop experience. So in April, the business office merged with Polar Express and with Parking Services. And July 1, effectively, our name changed to the Office of the Bursar. So there are still elements of parking, or that you might consider parking, that still fall under facilities, like the parking lot maintenance, the shuttles, allocating spaces, those kinds of things. I work with facilities still. It's been kind of a transition to get everything split out, but we are still working with facilities, but parking does fall under the Bursar office. I don't know if there are questions. But that seems to be the concern, was that people weren't aware.
I just have a comment. I'm not housed on campus, so I only come up here like once a month. But the kiosks are not very friendly when they say they're temporarily out of service, but they don't tell you where another one is. And I know I drove around in 3 different parking lots and could not find another kiosk.
And was this just recently?
It was this morning.
This morning. Oh, okay.
So
I'll go back and report that.
So, I mean, there's a sign on it that says temporarily out of service. Please use another kiosk. But where are the other kiosks?
Okay.
Because I know, like, the other ones that I did know of are missing too. So.
Yeah, with the construction on campus, it was a great time to move parking to another division. But I know the kiosks are routinely moving just because of all of the construction, but. I will ask that they post on each kiosk where all of the other locations are.
Yeah, just something to help people out.
Okay. Which offices are now part of the Bursar's office?
Parking Services and Polar Express, the University Parking.
And the business office then? What else? Anything else?
Yeah.
I've got a comment or question maybe. One of the things that during construction I've seen from parking services was lots that are being cleared or closed shortly after the end of a business day, I should say, after 5 p.m. Notifications from parking services or from the Bursar office, I'm not sure at this point where that's coming from, seem to go by email and signs on a parking lot. And I've suggested that there's a good system that the university has that's powering UA alerts and could power a lot of other notification services, that you look at that and hopefully send out text messages for those of us who would like to be notified that way to avoid costly citations. And
right.
I mean, I'm one of them, but when I got to that lot, I looked around, and the cars that were there were OIT people because we had an issue and that needed to be resolved. And it isn't, okay, I can stop and move my car now because
right.
otherwise I'm going to get a ticket. So most of us that appealed that got denied. And if we would have gotten a notice on our cell phone, hey, you got 30 minutes, or in an hour you got to move your car, we would have likely done so.
Communication is one of the things I'm working on with regard to parking. You know, I've gotten a lot of complaints from people who didn't know that they didn't realize they had bought a 9-month decal and that it was expiring,
yeah.
and they just assumed they had a 12-month decal. And so, I am working on communicating that better. As far as actually the move and other pieces of correspondence that we want to get out, we've worked with marketing. We've done a lot of flyers and brochures and posted stuff in shuttles, but they're really trying to drive people to the cornerstone instead of using any listservs. And so I personally don't feel like the message is reaching people by using the cornerstone, but, you know, the more
yeah.
they use it, then hopefully people will start looking there for important information. But as far as text messages, yeah, I like to get text too, and I respond to those a lot faster than just about
yeah.
anything else, but I don't know what our capabilities are at this time.
There's,
UA
yeah.
is looking at something.
Yeah, the system that powers that, the UA alerts, is available for doing any kind of other notifications.
Okay.
So
okay.
it can do email, it can do text, it can do text to voice and call you.
OIT manages that?
Yes.
Okay.
So
if
help desk at alaska.edu.
yeah.
But my name is Chris Bex, and you can
okay.
use my name and say that's what I suggested.
Okay.
Is that the emergency management?
It's a system called Blockboard Connect.
I know.
It does emergency notification, but it does additional notifications as well. So it can do that, and, yeah, contact the OIT
okay.
for that.
Other questions, comments for Amanda? Any questions from online? Can you hear us all right?
Yeah, we can hear okay.
Right. Amanda, I got passed a note here. Have you heard about quarters being problems in the kiosks? Apparently, some people have had problems putting...
They don't accept
it? Nicole will fill us in.
I've gone downstairs a couple of times out of Signers. And seen a couple of people trying to put quarters in, and the comments that they were making were that it was, like, jammed full of quarters, that they could not put any more in. No, the actual parking meters.
Oh, okay.
I don't know.
I have not heard that, so I'll check into it.
I didn't personally offer to try putting quarters in to see if that was the case.
I will look into that. I hadn't heard that at all. Is that recently?
Late last week, I think.
Okay. If anyone has any additional questions, who would they contact? Is the phone number still the same and all of that?
7384 is the main number for the bursar's office. Debbie Hanson-Hill is the parking manager, and you can always contact me as well.
All right. Thank you, Amanda.
Great. Thank you. Thanks for being gentle.
Did you get warned before you came?
What's that?
Did you get warned before you came?
I've had my share.
Do you have more officer report?
That was the end of my officer's report, but I didn't allow you guys to ask any questions or have any comments. So just to remind you, it was CDAC, Smoke Free Campus, Wellness Program, Protection of Minors, and Bullying Training. Were there any questions on those topics?
On the protection of minors, do you know where we could go to find that? I knew that there was kind of a draft policy. I didn't know it had actually been adopted, and so if it's somewhere online to look at?
I do not have an answer to that, but will try to find that out and get back with you. And I'm assuming that when the training rolls out, there'll be a lot more information more readily available. And so that should be coming out in October, November, but I'll see if I can find a more immediate answer for you.
Thanks.
Ashley, this is Mary Alice. I have a question about the smoke-free campus. Can you hear me?
Yes.
What exactly entails the campus is one of the questions that I am getting a lot of. Does that include the dorms, the apartments, because they're technically?
It would include anything on university property.
But to be totally exact, it's not really clear. There's
okay.
not an official position from the university. You know, the university hasn't said this is what we're thinking about. It's right now, it's as far as I know, entirely at UAA with a student and faculty group there wanting to make the UAA campus smoke-free and their branch campuses smoke-free by sometime, I forget the timeline. It was in a news story recently.
So will UAA take this out to the rural areas too? I'm sorry, UAF?
That's a good question.
Yeah, it kind of sounds like kind of the position of all three chancellors at each MAU is that it'll be an all or nothing deal. That if it goes, it's for all of UA is kind of what Chancellor Rogers was getting at, is that it's going to be an all or nothing. It wouldn't be a pick a place kind
okay.
of deal.
Next Monday is the System Governance Council. I think I finally got that name right. And that's the staff, student, faculty, governance representatives from all three MAUs plus statewide and alumni. And there hasn't been an agenda for that, but I would assume that that's going to be a topic for that group since it touches on everyone. And my thought has been that the students are probably the biggest group to say, this is a really bad idea, or no, this is a really good idea. I would assume the students would probably have the most say to the Board of Regents, for any kind of policy change like this.
But with that being said, Chancellor Rogers does want to hear from UAF specific and staff as well.
But I'm sorry, this is Trish Winters. But we don't have a medium yet for giving that back, or what method does he want feedback in at this point?
Is staff affairs okay creating a survey? Staff affairs will create a survey to send out.
Okay. So we'll wait till that survey comes out to provide feedback.
Yes.
Okay, thanks.
Hi, this is Robin Winant online. Can you hear me?
Yes, we can.
Hi, I just have one question also. You had mentioned that it was for all. If it does go, it's for all UAF property. Is that only property we own, or is that, for example, at the Center for Distance Ed building, I think we still rent property there. Would it be effective there?
My assumption is that it would be effective anywhere where UAF is present, but again,
okay.
that's not anything that's in writing already.
Okay, thank you.
Basically, these are all
there are a lot of really good questions, and I don't think we have answers to any of them. So that would probably be part of any conversation is, if it were to happen, how would it be applied? Where would it be applied?
Mm-hmm.
What would it mean?
How would it be monitored?
Thank you.
I'll touch on it quickly. So the last bit that I wanted to share from my report came from Staff Alliance yesterday. The Staff Alliance Vice Chair met with President Gamble, and he gave her an informal, it's not a formal proposal, for compensation, and asked for feedback. And his proposal was a 2% increase, since it's funded 50-50 from the state, from the university. 1% would be from the state, 1% would be from the university, and a additional day of leave for staff that could either be cashed in separate from the normal 40-hour cash-in, or not normal, but what we have already, or used as a vacation day. And the thought being that that represents a 0.38% increase as well. So Staff Alliance had some discussion. The Staff Alliance chair would like to make a response to the president by Friday, and I know that's not really much time at all, but I wanted to bring this to all of you to ask for your questions, comments, so I can convey it back to Staff Alliance. Probably mostly over what do you think of the idea of a day of leave that could be cashed in or used as part of a compensation proposal?
Brad, is,
yes.
Is the day of leave for all university employees? Like, because salaried and not salaried, you have the personal day. So would this affect everybody?
I don't know about the difference between salaried and not salaried.
It sounded like it would be for all because there were comments from salaried positions that they would like to have that personal day.
Okay.
One comment made at Staff Alliance was that the, you know, the 1% increase that ASEA negotiated for general government employees at the state doesn't represent their step increases. So one suggestion was, well, we should ask for 2.5% as a pay increase and keep the day. And generally speaking, we liked the idea of the day. It sort of followed with the compensation task force proposals that looked for other ways to compensate, you know, that weren't necessarily wages. But with that, if there's any final questions or comments, and we'll have more time for comment later too. But if there are no more final comments, I'll turn it over to Chancellor Rogers when he is ready.
Good morning, everyone. And I actually don't have a whole lot today because most of what I want to say today I'm going to say on Thursday at the Welcome Back Convocation presentation. But I do have just a couple of things relative to items that are on your agenda. And that has to do with committees. The question was asked about the diversity action. What's the status? I received a report from the Student Diversity Task Force right at the end of the last semester. Talked briefly at that point with the University and Student Advancement about implementation. They decided really to wait until students came back to continue the conversation. So I'll be meeting with them next week on next steps and should have a more complete report for you next month. But they really didn't want to take actions while students weren't present. So that's why that's been on hold. I think both your leadership and I have a little bit of concern about the Work-Life Balance Committee, which has been inactive, and even while it was active, was relatively inactive. And so what I'm going to be suggesting is that we think about how to revamp that committee. And I think there are sort of two themes that we might consider with the administration working together with staff council and others. One is the original idea behind work-life balance was in part how do we address issues in in people's working conditions that affect outside of work. And I think the biggest issue that that group tackled was daycare, child care, which we've run up against again and again, the inadequacy of the availability of child care here in Fairbanks. And we've been working on a project, but it seems to be taking forever to try to expand the Bunnell House to be able to accept more a new location that would allow the acceptance of more children into the program and younger children into the program. No news out of the system office has been working with us on that. So other than child care, we didn't get a lot coming out of that. So the suggestion is we think about the what would make UAF one of the best places to work? What would be, and so this is partly about work and partly about other things. What could we do that would make UAF a preferred employer? So thinking about this as a best place to work committee and with what are the steps we could take. Perhaps a subset of that, perhaps an alternative to that, is thinking with a real focus on professional development. How do we, as an institution, do a better job of creating professional development opportunities for all of our staff? Particularly, I think I've mentioned this group before, as we enter into a time of budget uncertainty where we know people's positions are going to be impacted, some people taking on more work because we don't fill positions elsewhere, some people moving positions, the key strength we need for employees is how do we help you as employees develop the skills that allow you to make whatever transitions there are to stay employed with us. And so a second alternative there would be really focusing on professional development opportunities. So what I'd like to ask staff counsel is to think, put together maybe an ad hoc committee of staff counsel to work with us to figure out what would be the best way for the administration and the staff to work together on these issues and making this a better place to work and making it a place where if there is change in your department, that people aren't as threatened by the change because they know they'll be here after the change. And I've made the pledge to you before and will continue to make this, that if there are budget challenges in the next couple of years, as we expect, that given the normal turnover, we should be able to pretty much ensure that anyone whose job is affected, that there are other alternatives here within UAF. I think the bigger issue is going to be people who are in offices where vacant positions aren't filled, taking on new duties, and that really is how do we provide the training? How do we improve our systems? How do we find ways to reduce workload so that people aren't overworked? So, helping us think about how to work with those, I think, would be a really valuable effort for staff counsel. I know it would be valuable to me, and I think it's something worth doing. With that, let me stop, and I'll answer any questions people here or people online have. Well, I hope I'll see most, if not all of you, in person or virtually on Thursday afternoon at the welcome back convocation.
Thank you, Chancellor.
Thank you.
So we are on item 6, governance reports. We're a little early, but I'll ask is someone from Faculty Senate online? Or is there anyone from ASUAF online? Okay. So I'll move on to item 7, unfinished business. And postpone motions to amend the UAF Staff Council bylaws. And we have a motion that I believe is officially on the table.
Maybe Richard or Kirsten can correct me, since we postponed it. It's there. But motion number, now it's number 242-1, motion to amend UAF staff council bylaws to remove alternate seats on staff council.
This is Jeanette. For those of you online, I move to amend the motion that's on the table by adding the stipulation that currently sitting alternate members will become at-large members and will serve as full voting members of staff council until their term expires.
I would second that motion to amend.
Okay, we have a motion and a second. Jeanette, would you like to speak to what this would do?
Yes, I'm sure probably most people have heard this before, but we at Rural Affairs, the permanent subcommittee of staff council, wanted to endeavor to make sure that these changes to the UAF staff council bylaws do not negatively impact people on campuses with a smaller voting population. And this amendment is just one part of changes that we hope to implement that will prevent that.
And this is Kirsten. I think when we were initially talking about the proposed motions, I think the idea was that people that were alternates would, if they wanted to, would move into the at-large seats, and just going over the kind of the remaining motions, there wasn't really anything that made that happen, and we would be deleting all of the alternate language, and so those people who were still alternates would sort of be in a kind of a limbo. They may still be on staff council till their terms ended, but alternates don't have the same voting rights that other members do, so making them, calling them now at-large members instead of alternates will at least ensure that they get to participate fully instead of being kind of in limbo. Also, there are, it's my understanding, I think there are no alternates in the rotation that's coming up at the end of this year, but there are alternates who would be elected in the odd year. So the alternates would stay on kind of through what the term that they got voted into the last time, and we don't have any issues of replacing people right now. So if we're not ready, if the elections software and stuff isn't kind of ready to deal with adding at-large members right now at this first election cycle, we don't have people that are coming off and seats that need to be filled or anything, so it just seemed like it made a kind of a smoother transition to the new system.
This is Adam. I also wanted to make sure, did we include the language that restricted the number of at-large seats to any specific unit to two? So that, for example, of the... Yeah, go ahead, sorry.
Yeah, that's in another one of the motions, I think. Right, Jeanette?
Yes, it's in motion two.
Okay, thanks.
So any other discussions, questions, comments?
This is Jeanette. I have one more comment. One thing that we discussed quite long and arduously was that just to draw everybody's attention to the fact that at-large membership has no unit affiliation, and so folks that are in at-large seats will not be representing their unit per se, but the larger body of staff council or the larger body of employees that are represented by staff council. So that doesn't mean that the current people that are in alternates can have no loyalty to their units or anything, but they are those seats, just to remind everybody, are not affiliated with a particular unit.
All right. Well, hearing no more comments, we have a motion and a second. So let's go ahead and do a
Nicole. Do we need a roll call vote for an amendment, Stephen?
Okay.
Not for an amendment.
Okay. So all in favor on the room in the room, please say aye and raise your hand.
Aye.
And go ahead and keep them up for just a moment, although
it's unanimous.
Okay. And all in favor on the phone?
Aye.
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 I think that was that. Sorry, one more time online. Was that five? Five ayes that I heard?
Yeah, there's Debbie Gonzalez. So I got here late.
Well, yeah, it probably doesn't. There were no opposed in the room that I saw, any opposed online. Okay, the amendment passes unanimously. Pardon. So now we have an amended motion on the floor. Questions, comments about that item? Okay, hearing none. This would be a roll call vote, and it would require a two-thirds vote.
And if we could just maybe read the motion as amended.
That's a good question. Jeanette, does this? I see that the amendment is. Does it change the language of the motion?
Doesn't it? It adds. Adds a few words, doesn't it? So,
I suppose I could. The amended motion 2013-242-1, motion to amend UAF staff council bylaws to remove alternate seats on staff council, with the stipulation that currently sitting alternate members will become at-large members and will serve as full voting members of staff council until their term expires.
I'm suddenly thinking about this. An amendment should actually add, delete, or change some text to the motion itself.
Well, it does. So the motion is UAF staff council moves to amend the bylaws of the University of Alaska Fairbanks staff council as follows: to remove alternate seats from staff council with the stipulation that current alternates become at-large members with full voting rights, serving until their current term ends.
Right. What suddenly stuck in my head is, well, we don't need to actually, there doesn't have to be any change to the text of the bylaws for that. That's just an addition to the motion, so we're clear.
Oh, right, it's a new,
While it replaces something, it is a new addition.
But it's not, we're not adding text to the, we're not adding any text or changing any text from what's already been identified by EMR as changes to previously EMR to the bylaws.
Correct.
We're just
right. That's right. Because the alternates is getting, that part's getting stricken out, but we still just have this. The current alternates continue. Yeah.
So, any other discussion?
We do have one question.
Okay.
For Nicole. How many alternates are there currently that will be going in, that this would affect?
Conveniently, there are five.
There are five alternates, and what units?
There are two units, there are two alternates in Unit 1, and there are three alternates in Unit 15.
Which then brings the question of what happens if on the next motion, if there is a limit of.
Yes, you're absolutely right, and we could have that discussion now. Strictly speaking, that discussion should be when we talk about that motion. But, I mean, we could have it now. The
Well, let's get to the motion, I think.
Okay, we'll do that then. So, last call for discussion? It's not really the last call, but any more discussion? Okay, hearing none. Nicole.
Adam Kane?
Yes.
Kirsten Bay?
Yes.
Sarah Batiste? Deb Jepson? Mary Alice Short? Debbie Gonzalez?
Yes.
Leslie Walls?
Yes.
Debbie Coxon?
Yes.
Jesse Atencio? Aaron Albertson? Greg Simpson?
Yes.
Kim Eames? Debbie Blevins? Juan Gula?
Yes.
Robin Winant?
Yeah.
Trish Winters?
Yes.
Jennifer Youngberg? Jeanette Altman?
Yes.
Travis Brinzow? Richard Machida?
Yes.
Chris Beck?
Yes.
Is Tom Langdon online?
Okay.
Cindy Collins? Tony Abbey?
The motion passes unanimously. Thank you, Jeanette, for and Rural Affairs for working on those changes. And we don't have any current alternates who are now at large representatives online today, do we? Okay. So moving to next item, motion 242-3, the motion to amend staff council bylaws to reflect the addition of 5 at-large rep seats. Oh, did I skip a motion? I did, I'm sorry. 242-2, the motion to amend our bylaws to add 5 at-large representative seats to staff council. Yes, please, Jeanette.
I move to amend the motion by adding text to the second sentence of letter 7 of the motion in order to read, there is no unit or geographical designation to these 5 at-large members, semicolon. However, no one unit may occupy more than 2 at-large seats during any term.
I guess I would second that. But now that I didn't realize that I thought we only had 2 at-large, 2 alternates, but we've got, there are 3 alternates, I guess, in Unit 15.
That was my understanding, too. How do we get more than 2 alternates for one unit?
Because they have more than, they must have more than 2 seats. We have kind of as many alternates as there are seats, and some units have more than a couple. We could fix this by saying, effective in whenever the next they're voting when they would come off.
That would be for the 2015
election again.
Term.
So effective at the next odd voting cycle.
Mm-hmm. We could perhaps add language to that amendment that would stipulate that it would be effective for the next odd election, which will take place in fall of 2014 for the 2015 term.
How would that affect next year? could two, more than two, get voted in and during next year's election if we stipulated the 15 terms?
The way that the current motion reads is that there are five at-large seats. Seats two and four will be elected on the even year election. So when we have even numbered units, those two at-large seats would be voted in. And then the next year, odd years, when we do odd numbered units, one, three, and five seats for at-large would be elected at the same time.
I didn't realize we had five. I thought we had less than five so that we could number them, the ones that we had now, odd ones, and fill in. You know, since we now, if we've got five alternates who now are five at-large members, there won't be any election in, 2000, in this even one coming up, and it'll all have to start in the next odd cycle, and so it'll be a while before we get up to five, because it seems like the next odd cycle we would be voting seats one, three, and five, and then it won't be till the next even one that we would even be filling the seats two and four.
And this is Jeanette. If I could just add to what Kirsten is saying, the spirit of this amendment is not to penalize anybody. It is basically to protect the representation across campus and not allow, these seats, I wonder a lot of times, and I have wondered during this whole process, if we're making policy for something that is never going to happen. But we basically just want to include the safeguard that no one geographic or unit, geographic location or unit has unfair sway over staff council. Again, I don't think that it will really happen, and I'm not really worried about a coup, but we really just want to make sure that everybody has an equal chance of being elected to these seats.
So we currently have an amendment to the motion. It's been moved and seconded. I've been hearing we've had some conversation about some possible changes to that amendment. So is there a motion to change the amendment?
Yeah, the motion to change the language of the amendment.
You can have a amendment, and then you can have an amendment of the an amendment of the first order, an amendment of the second order. You can amend the amendment, but you can't go any further than that. So, really, what I'm asking is, do we have a motion to change amend Jeanette's amendment? And if not, then we should continue on and vote on this amendment. Can I make that any more confusing?
Well, if we call it, so what I had said, we have to add that this doesn't become effective until the next odd election cycle. And if I ask that that be a friendly amendment, and can you have a friendly amendment to an amendment, or can you only have a friendly amendment to the original motion? Because a friendly amendment, if it's accepted by the motion maker, we don't have to vote on it.
I would accept a friendly amendment if it is indeed my place to accept it.
I'm not enough of a parliamentarian to okay. Nicole Ashley tells me that whoever seconded the amendment would need to agree.
And I seconded the amendment.
Okay, well then.
So
could we state that?
Or we could withdraw the first one, and we could just do another one that includes them both, so we don't have to have amendments of amendments.
Well, at this point, you could do that. I'm not sure that would lead to any less confusion at this point. I think we're okay to continue as we are.
We're almost there at this point.
Yes. So
yeah, okay.
I'm
willing to give it a whack. Okay. I move to amend the motion by adding the text to the second sentence of letter 7 of the motion in order to read, there is no unit or geographical designation to these 5 at-large members, semicolon. However, no one unit may occupy more than 2 at-large seats during any term. This will be effective 2015.
And Kirsten, Richard, is that an acceptable change to a bylaws? Can we stipulate that a particular bylaw becomes effective at a date in the future?
I think it's been done before.
Okay.
But this brings up that if there are 2 more elected, then there will be 7 at-large seats for the first year.
I couldn't hear Richard.
Sorry. I was saying what this means is that in the first year there will be 7 at-large seats instead of 5.
This is Jeanette. I think that the motion that we just passed that would allow all of the current alternates to be at-large members may negate the need for an election since we already have 5 seats whose terms expire at the end of 2014.
I agree.
So, Richard, when you say that this would lead to 7 at-large seats,
well, assuming that we elect seats 2 and 4 this year.
Mm-hmm. Yes, in a normal cycle when all of the chips have fallen and this is part of our bylaws, of course we would have an election for seats 2 and 4. Motion number 1 that we just passed would basically convert all alternates to at large, and now we now have 5 seats whose terms expire at the end of 2014. So it is my suggestion that we do not have an election for alternate seats this fall.
And so I guess maybe what we need to do then is section 3D where it says that we'll number them 1, 2, 3, 4, and 5 and elect them in the even odd years, you know, again, maybe make that effective with the 2015 election. So at that election, we would be electing seats 1, 3, and 5, and it won't be until the following even election that we would fill seats 2 and 4. So there would be lesser number for that 1 year.
Okay, well that's a possibility to make a different amendment to
right.
the motion. So, yes. But it would be the same motion, but a new amendment. Yeah.
Question, since priority schedules and desires change over time, has anybody confirmed that these 5 at-large members are willing to continue?
That's an excellent question, and I don't know if that has happened.
I've just talked to the 3 in Unit 15.
And they're interested?
They were sort of sorry to see that they were maybe thrown out.
Oh, are they? So they are not interested in being at large, or they?
No, they are. But they are under the impression that they may be.
Again, Richard, it's hard to hear what you're saying.
Okay, I've talked to the ones from Unit 15, and you know, and a couple of them sort of voiced the opinion that they thought they were just sort of going to be dismissed after these motions passed. And they were kind of sad to see that happen.
And
this
so
is Jeanette. I was just looking at this, and it looks like under Section 3, Membership, Letter B, the first point talks about special elections, and if the seat is empty during the first year of a 2-year term, there will be a special election to fill this position at the next election cycle. The next election will technically fall within the first term of seats 2 and 4, or excuse me, the first year of seats 2 and 4. So we could, in effect, have a special election for seats 2 and 4 next fall, as well as the regular election for seats 1, 3, and 5. The 2 and 4 would be a one-year term because half of their term would already be expired, and then we would be on track.
Right. You mean if some of the current people didn't want to stay on?
Well, all of the current – my concern was is that in 2015 we will only be electing seats 1, 3, and 5, which would mean that 2 and 4 would be empty, so we would be serving 1 year with only 3 of our at-large seats filled. If we had a special election for seats 2 and 4 in along with the odd election, the odd unit elections, then seats 2 and 4 would be elected. Seats 1, 3, and 5 would be elected for a 2-year term. 2 and 4
yeah,
would...
Yeah, okay, I see what you're saying. Yep, that's... Good. Mm-hmm. Yeah, that's
all. That is mechanics of how it's implemented. It doesn't have to be part of the motion.
No, and I bring it up to say that it looks like there's already language in the motion to provide for any problems we might have with filling those seats.
Okay, and now to. I want to make a really dumb joke about, in all this confusion, have we talked about 5 amendments or 6, something like that. Anyway, to bring this back, we have an amendment to the amendment. So if there's any further discussion about Jeanette and Kirsten's amendment, which would make the no one unit occupy more than 2 at-large seats during any term effective 2015. If there's no discussion on that, let's move to a vote, or let's head to a vote.
What's that?
Jeanette, can you restate what we're voting on?
Yeah, I'm ready for it this time. Wait. Okay. I got to get my cheat sheet up here. Okay. I move to amend the motion by adding text to the second sentence of letter 7 of the motion in order to read, there is no unit or geographical designation to these 5 at-large members, semicolon. However, no one unit may occupy more than 2 at-large seats during any term. This will be effective 2015.
And what we're voting on right now is that last part, this will be effective 2015.
Fall.
Fall. No. For the 2015 term, to clarify.
So the election would be fall of 2014.
That's correct.
Okay. So, I think we are ready. I apologize. We're past the break, but we'll get to it here shortly, hopefully. So all those in the room in favor, please raise your hand. Unanimous in the room. All those in favor online, please say aye.
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 We have 5 people online. Is that right, Nicole? Okay. Then the amendment to the amendment passes unanimously. So now we are we have now Jeanette's amended amendment, which she read just a moment ago, on the table. Is there any discussion about that?
This is Leslie Walls. I need to interject. I have to drop out. I have another meeting to attend.
Uh-oh. Nicole, how many people do we have total? Are we at 13? And we had someone else join us, right? Yes, so we should still have quorum. Okay.
Yeah.
I apologize, but this is a critical meeting.
Thanks for attending, Leslie.
Thank you. See you next time.
We still have lucky number 13.
Okay. So if you leave, don't tell us, because if you tell us, then we have to reevaluate quorum. If you don't tell us.
Doesn't it only matter once, as long as quorum is established? I don't know that it has to be maintained, does it? I think as long as it was established.
I
we should just continue with the vote. But I think that if you don't know that it's changed, you're okay. But if you know that it's changed, then you do actually have to reevaluate quorum.
Oh, okay.
For better or for worse. I think that's I think that really is a rule, and it's not something I'm just making up. But
mm-hmm.
So to the amendment. Discussion? No? Excellent. Let's move to a vote. All those in favor in the room, please raise your hand.
Oh, sorry.
No, we're voting on the amendment, but we're still good. So all those in favor in the room, please raise your hand. Okay, all those in favor online? It was all.
Aye.
Aye.
I think did I hear five now online? Did we have four? Okay. I just heard someone double. All right. The amendment passes unanimously. So now we have amended motion number 24-2. Jeanette, would you be willing to
yes.
Read out the motion? Not necessarily the bylaw changes.
The motion. Oh, okay. Let me get my exact wording back up here. Hold on. Okay, so I'm reading the amended motion.
Yes.
Again. Okay. I move to amend the motion by adding text to the second sentence of letter 7 of the motion in order to read, there is no unit or geographical designation to these five at-large members, semicolon. However, no one unit may occupy more than two at-large seats during any term. This will be effective 2015.
And just for the record, 24 the other half of 242-2, the other half of the motion text, UAF Staff Council moves to amend the bylaws of the University of Alaska Fairbanks Staff Council as follows to add five at-large representative seats to Staff Council.
Thank you.
All right. Any discussion? All right. This will be a roll call vote.
Adam?
Yes.
Kirsten?
Yes.
Mary Alice? Yes. Debbie Gonzalez?
Yes.
Debbie Coxon?
Yes.
Greg? Simpson?
Yes.
Juan?
Yes.
Robin?
Yes.
Trish?
Yes.
Jennifer? Jeanette?
Yes.
Richard?
Yes.
Chris?
Yes.
Any representative's name who I did not call? 13-4.
So the motion passes unanimously. Thank you all, and I'm going to suggest that we interrupt this item of business, take 5 minutes, and a very short 5 minutes, and come back. Pat Pitney is our guest here at 10 o'clock. So I suggest we reconvene then. We'll come back to order and welcome Pat Pitney, Vice Chancellor for Administrative Services.
Well, thank you for giving me the opportunity, and I had an opportunity to talk to the Chancellor right before I walked in here. He got the budget proposal that's going to the board hot off the press. And I'll just mention a couple of things that he mentioned from that brief conversation, and also he also let me in on what he talked about with you earlier this morning, so we're fortunately very consistent with our messages. So the budget that's going to the board is the preliminary FY15 request for both operating and capital. The on the operating side, it's more favorable than we anticipated in terms of the program requests. There are about 1.7 million of UAF program requests for the system as a whole, about 3.8 million in program requests have gone forward. The on the fixed cost side, they're proposing both a 2% tuition rate increase and a 2% salary increase for fiscal year 15. So those are the kind of the big pieces out of there. They're assuming that utility costs will be covered by the trigger mechanism, which I won't go into here, but essentially the state would cover the increased utilities. We hope and pray. The and then that there will be some funding for M&R on the fixed cost side. So relative to the messaging we were getting when we first started the FY15 budget process, this is as good as we thought we would, better than we thought we would end up with. So we'll see how the board reacts. The board meeting is next Thursday and Friday, and see how they take it in. On the capital side, the R&R number is to be announced. I think the president wants the opportunity to talk to the governor. The governor has had this as a main priority, has put in $37.5 million for the university for the last several years on deferred maintenance and R&R. The president, understanding the size of our facilities, wants that number to be higher, and I think he's waiting to have that discussion with the governor before he talks to the board. For new construction, the engineering facilities are in, and there is also a kind of a to-be-determined number on the new heat and power plant. We know the number. It's $245 million for the UAF heat and power plant replacement, but we're trying to work with the state on a no-interest loan or other financing options so that it would be presented differently in the budget. So there's also some research projects that are being proposed to the board going forward, Earthscope, mapping, and one other project, I think the sustainability one. I don't know that. I haven't seen the list, so I'm going by memory from the phone call 10 minutes ago. But again, on the capital side, having engineering and having the heat and power plant replacement on there is very good, and I know the president's commitment to deferred maintenance and R&R, so that bodes well for us as well. So from that standpoint, it's very good, but we're at the infancy of the budget process. So that's FY15. This is the board's first look. The board will look at it again and approve it in November. It goes to the governor in November, goes to the legislature in December, comes out of the legislature in April, goes back to the governor. And we know in April, we kind of know where we're going to stand for the coming fiscal year. So we're early on, but at least it's good starting where we're starting. So that's very good. What I wanted to talk about today was more the kind of the budget context that we're facing going into fiscal year 15 and beyond, and a little bit about our current fiscal year. So for those of you online, we'll email this presentation out, but I will describe it well enough that I'm not a fancy presentation person, so you're not missing really cool pictures or anything. You're just missing my outline, so I know what I'm talking about. Where we came from in the last 5 years is a very flat research environment. So that's the first set of bars there. Our federal environment, with the exception of the ERA funds in 2010 and 11, our federal funding has been flat. Federal funding accounts is the second largest funding source for UAF after the state general fund. So the state general fund has done well. We're getting lots of messages, though, from the state because of the oil tax changes that the general fund is not going to be as plentiful as it has been in the past. The legislature is saying out loud, come in with flat budgets. Fortunately, we're not coming in with flat budgets, but you know, it's going to be tighter, thus the, you know, compensation change. But the general fund has been what has been holding this institution through. The next category is indirect cost recovery. That's almost a direct proportional relationship to federal. So federal's flat, indirect cost recovery is also flat. The next area is tuition. We grew a lot, actually, in tuition. Early in the 2000s, indirect cost recovery produced more revenue than tuition. Tuition both from the growing enrollments, but we also had relatively robust tuition rate increases. That was growing well, and it meant an $8 million difference for us across a five-year period. We're seeing that flattening. Our enrollment, although is better than all other in-state institutions right now, it's not growing very fast, and if we can maintain it, we're doing good. We have really good first-time freshman numbers, UA Scholar numbers, but overall, we're just flat. So with lower tuition rate increases, flat enrollment, we're not getting much revenue off our tuition. And the last category is kind of everything else, state and local grants, private grants. If we charge money to service a program other than an instructional program, it hits the university receipts. And our donations also hit university receipts. That is growing, but it's not growing fast. And so it probably is an area we have to explore overall as an institution. So this is where we've come from. What do we have looking forward? Our federal environment isn't changing. It's more and more competitive. Our only advantages are we are doing research in areas that are hot at the national level. So the work we're doing in the Arctic, the work we're doing with climate, the work we're doing with energy, our movement into the biomedical area, all of those bode well for us to be competitive. But when you have a federal environment that is reducing, we have to become more and more competitive just to stay even. So that federal environment is going to be tighter, and our hope is we just remain competitive and hold our current position. Many institutions are losing positions. The state environment, I mentioned briefly, we are totally dependent on oil for our tax revenue in the state. It makes up about 95% of tax revenue into the state is oil. So with the tax change, the oil tax change, depending on who you listen to, we're going to see a downturn in the short term and then an upswing. You listen to the other side, you're going to see a downturn. So we're going with the optimistic. We're going to see a downturn and then an upswing when there's more development going on. On the Board of Regents side, they're listening to that state dialogue, but they're also strong advocates for the university. So that's where I think this comfort in the Board of Regents request that the president's putting forward at the beginning is more optimistic than what the state oil dialogue is. But they're going to be hard over on us focusing on the SDI, on the Strategic Directions Initiative. So a little bit about where University of Alaska Fairbanks lands relative to peers. And you have several, and I'm not talking necessarily in-state peers, I'm talking about how we compete nationally. From a funding perspective, as a research university, we get more state general fund to support our programs and services and facilities than any other public state higher education organization for research, any research university. So we're in a really, really good position. And fortunately, not a lot of people at the state level look at what's going on in the other research universities in terms of the amount of revenue that they generate themselves. Relative, though, to the other universities in the system, we generate more non-general fund revenue than any of the other universities, and that's because of our research mission. So it's kind of, we're doing well if you just look in-state. If you look at peer universities like the University of Alaska Fairbanks and other places, we're well-funded from a state perspective. So as the state funding gets tighter, that we can anticipate that coming up as an argument. From a management perspective within UAF, we're relatively decentralized. Our schools and college and research institutions, I say those are our business units. So we have 17 business units, all with a different business model, generating proportionally different amount of revenue. But each one operates kind of within their, with their own realm, and their success is dependent on different criteria. So if you look at the College of Liberal Arts and you look at the Institute of Arctic Biology, the dean of the College of Liberal Arts is not thinking about the same things as Brian Barnes is thinking about for the Institute of Arctic Biology. And so from an institution perspective, we have to be flexible, and we have to depend on those business units and help each business unit be successful. And I think that's a real key component here, because that's where our success as an institution is, the health of all of our units. And I think it's a big strategy point as we make decisions going forward. So a little bit about what it means money-wise. If state general fund is, for a three-year period, is zero versus a 2% growth, that means $16 million. Tuition rate, the difference between 2% and 5% is $800,000. Enrollment, the difference between dropping by 1% and growing by 2% is $3.8 million. So big swings on many operational things. If research didn't grow versus research growing at 3%, that means $6 million. Okay, so you look at those numbers and then you look at the expense side. Compensation at 3%, $24 million. So we have to be on the optimistic side of all of the state general fund, the tuition rate, the tuition enrollment, and the research to meet a 3% compensation increase. Other costs, if we just look at CPI, that goes up 8.3. So this kind of explains this kind of disconnect and why we were at an $8.5 million budget gap this last year. Our revenues are slowing down. Our fixed cost base, our just normal cost increase, is overshadowing our ability to earn revenues. And so that's what put us into this gap. The gap's not really going to go away, but with the strategies we put in place this year, I think we'll face them in a much better position coming into this next year. So what did we do this year? And I think I'm sure everybody is affected by the 90-day vacancy. So, you know, we're holding staff positions open for 90 days, and we were anticipating about a $3 million return just on that vacancy. Now, those are one-time savings. When you hire the person, then you're back to base costs again. But since the 15th of May, when we put this in place, we have 84 positions have vacated. Of those, 43 have been held open with the budget draw. 26 have asked for expedited recruitment but still have the budget draw. 11 have been approved for recruitment without a budget draw out of the 84. Two are pending, and two have partial budget draws. And actually, the two in question that had partial budget draws were mine if I successfully recruited a candidate in the time period, and they will have the same budget draw because I haven't got them on board as both police chief and the grants and contracts director. and they'll be vacant for 90 days easy. So we're not on top of that one in terms of getting them replaced. So those two that were approved, what I had asked for is if I get somebody hired, stop the budget draw at the time I hire them. But it's easily going to be 90 days. So in terms of how it affected units, the chancellor's office had three. Okay, the chancellor's office has five people. Three are affected by this draw. CRCD has 13. The provost 14. My area has 32. Trust me, I'm feeling it. VCR has 5, and the VC, University Relations and Students, is 13. So, a decent spread except for mine at 32. Diane, thank you. But significant savings, we're expecting in the range of $600,000 already, which, given the time period, that puts us at $3 million at the end of the year. So this covers a lot of the costs. But, people are feeling it because there's open positions and jobs that need to get done. Other things we're doing, reducing off-campus lease space. Wells Fargo folks are moving in actively or almost moved in by now. And so we're out of the Wells Fargo lease. We're looking at energy management. Our first round of energy projects went into place, and we anticipate between $500,000 and $600,000 of energy savings. That was on 10 buildings. We'll start another set of buildings coming up. Identified program reductions. So these are the vertical reductions. You've heard about some of them are moving faster than others. I think the biggest one out there is the career services. And in ours was the business office and Polar Express and parking reorganization. So staff benefit rate reduction was another ability for us to meet our budget gap. And then lastly, we're making up the difference with any of our year-end balances. So that was the plan. So the vacancy savings is the biggest piece of the savings. And to the degree that after 90 days, units can see the ability to keep that position open or maintain it, that savings goes to the unit. And the only way we can get base savings is the degree to which we don't rehire some of those vacant positions. We're not imposing that, but the 90-day wait period allows people to see which ones we can afford to leave open and which ones we can't. The things that the chancellor is telling management on an everyday basis, that this is what we need to be doing, is the streamlining processes. And I want to thank Ashley for being part of the PIT crew. So she's got an active role in that. Julie Queen also an active role in our process improvement effort. Additional revenue, so this goes back to the units and how competitive the units are, both from a student enrollment perspective and a from a non-general fund, the research perspective, or for athletics, fundraising, ticket sales, those kind of things. We've embarked on a major project to get a much better handle on our space and how our space is allocated. Besides people, space is our next most costly operation at the university. So we spend $20 million roughly in utilities and $40 million or another $20 million in maintenance. So roughly $40 million of our overall budgets on space. So how we use that space to attract students and earn monies is a really important component. But that's a several-year project. This year is just to get everybody agreeing that, yes, that space is where I live, and this is who I have in it. And so that's the first year. And then the second year is what criteria do we want to allocate space on? Will there be moves? And so much space is specialized that, the space was built for the program. The program's going to stay in it. So we don't see a lot of change, but where we can on the margins, it can make a big difference. our focus on SDI will maintain. And the chancellor's pushing hard that each vice chancellor does a full review of their programs and services. We've done the administrative staff review consistently for the last several years. We have to take that down to a much more office-by-office perspective. The vice chancellor for research is working on the research review. And then, of course, Provost Hendricks has been doing program review consistently all along. Administrative and staff support, I already mentioned. And then working on public-private partnerships. So this Wood Center addition is a public-private partnership. We went into partnership with a development group. They're building it. We're paying the lease. To the degree that we can increase food business and housing business, we have more people coming through here. That's what pays for it. And so we didn't have to put up the capital, but we have to pay for it over time. After 30 years, we're paying a flat rate lease fee, that will become ours. If we can pay more early, we can pay it off early, and as soon as we pay it off, it becomes ours. So it's a lease-to-own item. We may want to do more of those. I mean, we're still trying to look to see if housing is going to work. So where does staff come in? Overall, in terms of where we spend our compensation dollars, staff is 47%. Students is 6%. Students has increased from 3% 5 years ago to 6%. So we're using a lot more student labor, and I think that's very good because they become our regular employees afterwards. Executives, 4%, and faculty, 43%. So staff, from a compensation standpoint, is a big component of what University of Alaska is all about, University of Alaska Fairbanks. Where are staff? So traditional admin, finance, HR, IT, procurement, facilities, police and fire. So the traditional administration on the unrestricted side is a large component after the faculty and the research. So that's traditional administration is a large component, and it is dropping ever so slightly. Our student services and communication staff has been a major investment area and will continue to be, especially as we come up on the 100th anniversary. And so that is growing. Where we're losing staff is in where we call our research and program area. And this is federally funded programs that are staff-oriented versus faculty-oriented. I mean, we're losing a lot of faculty-oriented programs as well. But where we had at Cooperative Extension, we might have had 10 staff on a grant. Or ARSC, for instance. That research and program staff, ARSC was a big share of that. Alaska Satellite facility has fewer direct restricted staff than in the past. So that's where we're seeing our biggest reduction in staff, is that where other people are directly paying for it. So, and then the faculty and research are holding steady. So in terms of movement, and we're watching this all the time, and we believe that the traditional administration were being able to decline ever so slightly because of the processes we're doing. But in general, you know, we're able to do it because we have committed staff. We've got staff committed to the institution. They work hard. People are seeking training and education, and I know the chancellor talked about how do we create the staff development opportunities. How do we work together to create that staff development opportunities so that as some jobs go away and other jobs are there to be taken, that the people have the skill set and the knowledge to take those different jobs on. And I think it comes down to education and training, and it's a discussion I have with my direct report. But if you build a task force, or maybe we can combine forces, and because that's that staff development area that is really important. How do we get people a broader range of skills, but still being able to do the job they're in at the time they're doing it. Build technical expertise, work across traditional boundaries. And this is really emphasized by what Ashley's doing with the PIT crew, and where we're bringing people in from the units to help with our process improvements. We're not trying to do it from a central area, but we're reaching out to the schools and colleges, different units, and different central units. Ashley's in student services, right? And saying, okay, as an institution, how do we do this thing that touches everybody a little bit better, and how do we do it together? So getting away from the traditional boundaries and having employment relationships or just the culture that people will say, yeah, I can work on that team, or I can go over and work in this unit for a day. How do we make it flexible within our institution to allow one person to move back and forth as they're able to contribute the most to the institution? And that's going to be a thought process, and it's an excellent role for this group to say, hey, how would that work for your unit? I mean, you have to be there, if you could work 4 days here, could you work one day in a function where it would make a huge difference? Could you work 6 hours here and 2 hours there? Or do you sit in the same place, but 2 hours of your day goes to, contributing to another unit's shortfall? How do we do that? Because when we looked at that travel function, we saw some units having one person that processed 1,200 travels a year and do it just fabulously. And then we have another unit that processes 300 with a full-time person, and we spend a full-time person's job correcting what they're doing. So it's like, if we've got a strength, how do we capitalize on that strength? Or how do we teach this person who might be totally isolated in a unit where they don't have anybody to help them, how do we connect those dots? What can we do as an institution to open those doors? So that's what goes on in my brain pretty much every day. How do we get everybody participating in process improvement from their job level to their unit level to their functional level across the institution? And then how do we keep the communications lines open where something's just not working? How can I get help? Who do I call? Who do you call? Who does a supervisor call that says, hey, I got 3 employees here, and I need them to be trained up in X, Y, and Z. Who can help me? How do we create that capacity in this institution to make people flexible? Because it's our staff strength that's going to make this institution work well. So it's a long way around how do we get from the budget environment to what staff can do and help me help the staff do that. So with that, I'm open for questions, and we also have that fine website, and thank you for anybody that has participated in it. We've gotten some good ideas off of the budget website. A lot of them had to do actually with energy management and lights and so forth, so it has prompted us to put our next energy projects on in particular buildings based on some of the comments we've gotten. So pass that website out to people and ask for that. But any questions?
Richard. I saw Mary Alice first.
Oh, I was just going to ask, you said you were going to send this out to the people online. Are we all going to get a copy of this too?
Yeah, we
okay.
can. Richard?
Just a quick question. On that very first graph you showed, was that after cost of living increases or anything like that? Or is it just raw number?
That one?
Yeah.
Raw numbers.
Yes.
Yeah, so nominal dollars, federal, we're going down.
Mm-hmm.
And in fact, if you extended that back to 2006, that's how long we've been flat. Now, the fortunate thing on the research side is some of the research has switched over to the university receipts where it's come from state or local or private. And so still flat, but not as flat as on the federal side.
I had a question.
If we receive research funding from the state, where does that go? It doesn't go under federal receipts? It
goes under the university receipts.
Oh, okay.
When it comes in on, like, the capital aspect or when it comes in as an RSA project, it comes in under the university receipts, not under the general fund.
And then another question. On the graph, you had a difference between staff research and faculty research. And I was trying to figure out, let's see.
In this one?
Yeah.
So we were trying to, okay, this is everybody, all employees at the university converted to FTEs. So the faculty and research, so that's faculty, coaches, all research-funded staff that are restricted funded, so direct research funded, or actually any direct restricted funded person. The research and program staff are actually, the faculty and the research are just like research technicians and so forth. This research program staff are like general administrative or fiscal or so forth that are funded on research.
Mm.
So the more traditional admin type people versus like a research analyst is on the faculty and research staff side. So we're just trying to categorize them in buckets that kind of denoted, well, the main one was traditional staff versus program directed staff.
Pat, this is Trish Winters. I'm really excited about the things that you're talking about as far as figuring out how to be more flexible as an institution. How do we stay in touch with what's happening in that area and be part of that conversation?
I think one thing that I would suggest is get on one of the process improvement teams at this point in time. We're trying to build our training, I want to say system, but we want a much more robust training capacity. And so, like within admin services, we're first doing the inventory of what training is out there and available, and then we're going to be seeking participation from unit personnel that we perceive are the experts and say, help us build this training. You don't necessarily have to give the training, but we need your expertise in building it and then being available for questions to help folks out. Because, and we'll also have many central people that serve as the experts as well. But what I've really noticed is that we depend on one person in the institution, whether they're in a central office or a unit office, that does something really well, and we just keep going back to them. What we want to do is get what they have in their brain onto paper and get four or five other people onto that. But we need their participation. So we're trying to build that inventory right now, and there will be a work team around that, and I think that would be the way to wrap it around that staff development work team. So in the next coming months. But in the short term, being involved in a process improvement team, and Julie Queen would be a good contact person to find out which ones there are that are active and which ones you might best fit with.
Thank you.
Can I comment on that, just the stuff I've heard from coworkers, and is that I think everybody looks forward to doing more professional development. But that with, for example, that 90-day hold, or freeze as they call it, puts more burden on staff. And a lot of us are buckling down and doing that, leaving very little time for professional development or no time. And so while it looks encouraging numbers-wise, I don't know if this has been addressed, but I think the morality of staff, is wearing down.
Maybe it's morale.
Morale.
I think we have high morality.
I think that's wearing down. And if anything is being done to help that, I don't think that's being communicating correctly. And I don't know if you're the right person to talk to about that. But I'm hearing increasing voices from people I work with that are getting tired of hearing that we still need to save money and they're expecting to do more with a lot less. And I think that's wearing them down.
Well, I think we're going to have to figure out how to do what we do differently and how we cannot do certain things that we're currently doing because they're not adding value. Because there is a point where you can't do more with the same number or fewer. So it's what are we doing that is less value-added than something more value-added? And that takes a lot of thinking. But in terms of we are in an environment for the next 3, 4, 5 years that we're going to have to save money. There will be that demand. So for the people who want that to change, in our environment, that's not going to change. There's going to be this pressure to do things more efficiently. But what I'm finding is the best way we can do it is to not do something that's not adding value. And how do you address the morale? I think is to find, and this is where this task force can help us, and so this is my opinion, and I am the right person because HR runs under me as well, but if people can see a change, and if people can be part of a change, and if people can let go of something they're doing to do something that's more important, and they see that it's a positive switch, that really changes morale. But that means how do we as an institution get a lot more people involved in that area? And that's where having a group of people that can advise on, well what's noticeable? If I have a supervisor that will assign me to this task so I get a different skill set, is that noticeable to them or is that a burden? What makes it
Let me interject for a moment. I'm loath to disrupt a really good discussion and conversation. We've got 15 minutes left, but I'm sure we're going to go over today, and we have a lot of agenda to go through. So just maybe like a two-minute warning, try and wrap up. I apologize.
Yeah. Just I'll make one comment. I'll leave it at that. I think that's excellent, and I think you can really do that. I think that process or that willingness to have people involved, I think, isn't being communicated effectively, I guess.
That's why I'm here.
Cool, yeah.
And that's why the chief
I have a...
Yes, please. We haven't heard from online, so is there a question online?
Yeah. This is Adam. I'm at the Bristol Bay campus, and you used the word adding value and adding value for different programs and different things. Are any of our peer universities that you've compared us to for other things any more profitable for us, profitable than us? Are they making, do they have more value than us? And then also, is that our goal? I realize we can't operate in a deficit, but as a nonprofit, I don't know where to draw the line. Do you have any thoughts about that?
So, I think I was looking at value-added processes versus value as an institution. I think we as an institution are highly valued, and we are public, and we will be subsidized. And the community campuses will be subsidized at a rate much higher from an instructional and program standpoint than the main campuses because of their economies of scale. It's the fact that the revenue is not increasing at the same level as our costs if we do continue to do everything as the same way we're doing it. So we can't, we will still be subsidized greatly and we still have high value to our public, but as a as an organization we have to fit within our revenue bounds. So it's, this isn't at all about a value question for the institution. It is highly valued. It is how do we fit within our revenue constraints and provide the most value that we can within that constraint.
Thank you.
Thank you.
One, any last question? Take one more. All right, hearing none. Thank you very much. Okay, so we are back to unfinished business, motion 242-3 to amend UAF staff council bylaws to reflect the addition of 5 at-large representative seats.
I have no amendment.
Everybody looked at you for
I know.
Oh, I'm cool with that. I just pulled it.
I saved it.
All right. Is there any other discussion on this?
Okay.
Nicole, is it kosher for me to do a roll call vote? Am I allowed to do that?
I'm cool with that.
Can I? What's that? Yeah, read. So could I call on, while I look at the notes, could I call on Jeanette or Richard or Kirsten to read the motion?
Yes. Motion 2013-242-3, motion to amend UAF staff council bylaws to reflect the addition of 5 at-large representative seats.
All right. We have a motion on the table. We have no amendments. Any further discussion? This would basically just, yeah, change our bylaws to reflect the changes that we made with our first two motions. So, hearing no discussion, move to a roll call vote.
Adam?
Yes.
Kirsten?
Yes.
Mary Alice?
Yes.
Debbie Gonzalez?
Yes.
Debbie Coxon? Greg Simpson?
Yes.
Juan Gula?
Yes.
Robin?
Yeah.
Trish?
Yes.
Jennifer?
Yes.
Jeanette?
Yes.
Richard?
Yes.
Chris?
Yes.
Anybody's name who I did not call?
Okay. The motion passes unanimously. There are no amendments. Wait. So to motion 242-4, Jeanette, may I call on you one
yep.
more time?
For four?
Dash four, yes.
Motion 2013-242-4, motion to amend UAF staff council bylaws to allow proxies.
Any discussion on this motion? Okay, we'll move to a roll call vote.
Adam?
Yes.
Kirsten?
Yes.
Mary Alice?
Yes.
Debbie Gonzalez?
Yes.
Debbie Coxon?
Yes.
Greg?
Yes.
Juan?
Yes.
Robin?
Yes.
Trish?
Yes.
Jennifer Youngberg?
Yes.
Jeanette?
Yes.
Richard?
Yes.
Chris?
Yes.
Anybody whose name I did not call? Unanimously.
All right. Yep, motion passes unanimously. Thank you all to previous EMR, this is, and to Rural Affairs, to current MNR and E, who are going to have to sort some of this out. Long process, what, now a year and a half going, and I doubt it's over, but we can take a breath. So with Council's permission, I'd like to move item 9A, and we'll postpone that to the next meeting, the 2014 meeting schedule. But please take a look at it and see if you know if there are dates that simply won't work that might work on a better day. Item 9B, the Staff Council Calendar Ad Hoc Committee, looking to create a committee of 2 to 3 people, optimally, you know, at least 3. But we'll need to have get the calendar going and get it ready and printed by December, early January. So do I have any volunteers? It's not an arduous process. It does take some work. Most of the work gets done by Wood Center Graphics, and they've got last year's templates, and we have all of the history, and we can share it with you.
And Staff Appreciation Day Committee has the 3 pictures that were voted on by staff. That might help you narrow down a background photo.
That's all the committee does?
That's right. The committee, yeah, the committee is responsible for selecting a, soliciting for a photo, which we sometimes do. We haven't always. Selecting a photo, working with Wood Center Graphics on the design of the calendar, making sure that everything's proofed so that all the dates are correct, all the holidays are correct, pay period dates, et cetera. If there's anything I've forgotten, I know we have it in documentation. But that's basically the job.
Is there a line item budget for that then?
Yes, it's part of our governance budget.
All right, I'll volunteer.
All right, thank you, Greg. Okay.
Yeah.
Do we have any other volunteers?
Third would be good.
Sure.
What's that, Richard? Awesome. And I was previously on the committee, so was Sarah Batiste, so feel free to call on us. I'd be happy to come to the first meeting and help go through the history of it.
And I'll track down those photos and get them to Nicole to send out.
What's the timeline for this?
I'm sorry to say we got you a little late, because we usually start this a month ago. Yeah, I know. Isn't it fun? It don't worry. We usually spent the first month not doing much, so you're still on time. You just have to start now.
And it sort of depends on whether we actually solicit photos or not.
Right. I'll talk to you about timeline after the meeting, either via email or just in person here immediately after. But December, January. The earlier we can do it, the easier we can get it printed. But it's happened that we've been late in the calendar. This year's calendar wasn't out until really early February, so we'd like to avoid that.
Brad, can I say something?
Yes, please.
Hi, this is Robin online. This has
Robin,
nothing.
Yes, I'm sorry, I didn't mention you. You were on the committee too.
Yes, I think I was. I just want to mention something really quick about the staff council meeting schedule. I know you just postponed it till the next meeting, but I thought back in May we decided to cancel June's meeting. Was that just this past June, or was that every June?
I think that's just that was the June 2013 meeting.
Okay. I thought we had agreed that we were no longer going to hold a June or a July meeting. I was confused.
I'll double-check the minutes, but I think normally we just, at that point, you know, in the May meeting, we decide if we need a June meeting.
Oh, I see. Okay. That's all I needed to add.
Okay. And so we can have it on the record. I would accept a motion to create the 2014 Staff Council Calendar Committee.
Sure. So moved.
Okay.
We have a second. Any opposed? Okay, hearing none. We have a ad hoc calendar committee. All right. So moving to item 10, committee reports. We have rural affairs attached. And thank you to Kirsten, who's acting chair for MR. I know that's not the committee she wants to end up in, but she's willing to help get it going. So extra thank you to that. For the
Right, and just, I guess, just to say on that, you know, we haven't met, but we're going to, and I guess the former elections EMR committee schedule the first Monday of the month, I don't know who gets to take that slot over, whether it's elections or meetings, membership and rules, but we'll have a joint meeting there to try to sort out the details of the two committees and when they'll be meeting and who's on what. So if you're interested in that, I think it's the first Monday in the month.
So, chairs, please send your meeting information to Nicole so we can get it on the calendar, and possibly also announce it just out to all of us so we know when the committees are meeting.
And we definitely need more people.
Yes. Advocacy, M&R, and E, I think, are at 3, 2, and 2 people, respectively.
You have two?
I'm counting Tony. I don't. She may not be interested. So, is there anything more from the? And apologies to rush through you, but is there anything more from the committee chairs? Okay. Well, similarly, we'll rush through item 11, the external statewide committee reports. Have any comments from our external committee representatives, or any questions about the committees? I will add that we were following up on parking advisory. The committee itself is inactive, but the ad hoc subcommittee that was reviewing parking citations is apparently still active. So both Martin Klein and Amanda Waller, know about that committee and I think want to get parking advisory going again. All right. So nothing for – sorry, any other external committee reports? Or comments? Okay, nothing ad hoc. So item 15, roundtable discussion. Thank you all for didn't do too badly on time, but thank you all for participating. Everyone who's here. If we didn't have quorum today, it would have been an unfun circumstance. So special thank you for everyone for being patient and for being willing to consider our motions and those amendments. No problem. Regarding that informal proposal for an extra day that could either be cashed in or used as leave, feel free to meet me or talk to me after the meeting or send me an email. Let me know what you think, if that's at all acceptable as far as part of compensation, or if you'd rather see something like a